The gospel reading is Luke chapter 4, verses 1 through 13. Jesus, full of the Holy Spirit, returned from the Jordan and was led by the Spirit in the wilderness, where for 40 days he was tempted by the devil. He ate nothing at all during those days, and when they were over, he was famished. The devil said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command this stone to become a loaf of bread." Jesus answered him, "It is written, one does not live by bread alone." Then the devil led him up and showed him an instant all the kingdoms of the world. And the devil said to him, "To you I will give their glory and all this authority, for it has been given over to me, and I will give it to anyone I please. If you then will worship me, it will all be yours." Jesus answered him, "It is written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him." Then the devil took him to Jerusalem and placed him on the pinnacle of the temple, saying to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you to protect you, and on their hands they will bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against the stone." Jesus answered him, "It is said, do not put the Lord your God to the test." When the devil had finished every test, he departed from him until an opportune time. The word of the Lord.
I think it's true to say for pretty much everybody that deep down, all of us want to be able to be useful to other people. We all have gifts, right? Things we're able to do well. And even though there may be times in our lives where we feel like too many people are asking us for help, we may feel overburdened at moments. Generally, it kind of feels pretty good to have our gifts recognized and utilized by other people. I remember about learning this truth from my grandparents in different ways. One of my grandparents, my grandfather, we used to go and visit him when I lived in California. I was growing up, and he was a big Lakers fan. And he had this TV with a VCR back in the Stone Age when people used VCRs, right? And so he would want to record the games. And then often when I'd go over to visit him, my friend would come along. And I started noticing that every time we would both come to his house and he'd want to watch a Lakers game or have it recorded, he would take my friend Cliff and say, "Hey, Cliff, would you mind showing me how to turn on the recorder so I can record this Lakers game?" And so he'd do it once, and then the next time I'm over, "Hey, Cliff, can you show me how to turn on this recorder to record a Lakers game?" After a while, several times, I thought, boy, you would think he'd learn by now, but I guess maybe he's just not good at VCRs. But as it turned out, one day he took me aside. He's like, "Yeah, Paul, I know I always ask him to do this, but I think he's kind of good at VCR stuff, and I think it feels good for him to know how to do something, so I just let him record my games every time he comes over." And at the time, I thought, that's kind of a silly thing, you know, if you think you could do it yourself. But over time, I saw it is true that if someone feels like they do something well, it's not always a nice thing to take it away from them as if, oh, you don't have to worry about it. A lot of times, people want to give their gifts. I remember my grandmother on my mother's side, she lived in Kentucky. We would go visit her, and so she kind of did this big southern grandmother thing where she'd fix all kinds of food every time the family was over. And this gave her so much purpose. I mean, if you were sitting there with she'd put a big cup and she'd say, "Would you like some milk?" And you'd say no, and she'd pour you a big glass of milk anyway. I mean, she just wanted to serve. You probably have had people in your life like this too. And imagine if we had come in and said, "Hey, Grandma, you don't have to make meals. Just sit and be with us and don't worry about cooking. We're going to take that over for you." You know, that would have made her very sad because this was a way she could give to the family and find meaning in her life. And I realize that's true about myself. You know, once in a while as a pastor, someone will come in to the office and come to Pastor Steve or maybe me and say, "Pastor Paul, I have this faith issue I'd like to talk about." And a lot of times they're apologetic. "I'm sorry, I don't mean to take up your time, but I'd like to talk about this faith thing in my life." And I am always like, "No, don't be sorry. I'm a pastor. I'm weird. I want to talk about faith, and I never get to. So come on in and talk about faith. This is what I do." You know, so isn't there something also for you that you do really well, probably better than most people, that you actually enjoy being asked about, that you actually enjoy doing for others? Maybe you're mechanical. Maybe you're crafty. Maybe you're good with fashion or design. Maybe you're musical. Maybe you're someone people can go to talk to. Maybe you're good with money. Maybe you're good in a subject like math or science. Maybe you're a leader. I mean, there's a million different gifts we can have. But I think it is true that it feels good to use our gifts, to have them recognized, and to have them utilized. And I think the reason for this is that God structured the world, and he structured human beings in a way where the best way to use our gifts is in service to other people. Because actually that's why God gives us gifts. That's what gifts are for sharing with other people. Well, I believe, and I think the church has always said, that the deepest gift that Jesus Christ had was his strong sense of relationship to God, his Father, right? Everything Jesus was able to do, the things Jesus was able to preach, the courage and single-mindedness he had in his ministry, the fact that he was able to trust God even to go to the cross, all of that was based around Jesus' unshakable connection with his God, with his Father. The church has a word for this relationship kind of thing, this strong relationship to God, and we have a simple word called faith, right? That's what we call a trusting relationship with God. And that's what it is. Most essentially, faith is just trusting not just that a God exists, but that the God that exists has loved me and claims me as his own child in Jesus Christ, right? That's what faith is. And Jesus had faith. I mean, he trusted God. That was the center of his identity. He knew he was God's beloved son. This is what we find in the story of Jesus' baptism, where Jesus is being baptized, and from heaven, the voice of God comes down and says, "This is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased," right? Jesus had faith. The question of this story becomes, what is Jesus going to do with his faith, right? How is his faith, how is Jesus' connection with God the Father going to inform the way he lives in the world and the way he lives out his mission? And so today's story is all about answering that question. How is Jesus' faith going to lead him to live? And so God leads him out to the wilderness. Now in the Bible, the wilderness is the place of testing. We can find many examples of this. The wilderness in this part of the world is not really a wilderness full of trees and water. It's more of a desert. And so it's a place of scarcity, it's a place of challenges and temptations, and the wilderness is kind of a metaphor for the place where someone's trust in God is tested, right? Is the trust in God a deeply rooted faith, or is it just a superficial faith, like a mask that we wear when it's convenient? So the wilderness is a place for testing, and we can find lots of examples in the Bible for this. Probably the most famous one is the story of the Exodus, where God has led the Israelites out of Egypt, out of captivity. And it says in the book of Exodus that for 40 years, the Israelites wandered the wilderness on their way to the promised land, and really in this process of being formed into God's people and being tested in their faith. And the truth is that many times as they wandered through the desert for 40 years, they were relapsing into a place of untrust, into a place of not trusting that God will take care of them. You know, for instance, they'd be short on food or water. And even though God had done all these amazing acts in the past, they would start saying things like, "You know what? It would have been better if we were still slaves in Egypt than to be stuck in the desert without water and food." Or their leader, Moses, would go up on a mountain to pray and to consult with God. And when he came back, the Israelites would have built an idol and they were worshiping a totally different God. So the Israelites had trust issues. But this wasn't just a reality about the Israelites, of course, 2,000 years ago. But this is a reality of humanity, right? As humans, we've always struggled to put our trust in God and in God's ways and in God's ways. To really trust that God is the center of our life, our happiness, our meaning. You know, we've always struggled to trust that. We've always been tempted to turn towards other strategies, other ideas, other ways of finding prosperity and power and happiness. Well, in this story, God has become human in Jesus, and now it's Jesus' turn to have his faith tested in the wilderness. So in this story, here comes the devil. And the devil begins to offer Jesus different visions about how he can live out his power and his status as God's son. And it's interesting, Jesus up to this point has not begun his ministry yet. And so what Jesus is going to do in this story and the decisions he's going to make and how he's going to live out his faith are in some ways going to set the stage for his future ministry and his future mission. So Satan offers Jesus three different visions for how he can live out his faith. The first temptation is for Jesus to use his power to turn a stone into a loaf of bread. The second temptation is for Jesus to worship the devil and thereby gain dominion over all the kingdoms of the world. And the third temptation is for Jesus to test God by jumping off the top of the temple of Jerusalem to see if God will really protect him. Well, each of these temptations, like I said, are different visions for how Jesus can live out his faith, and each of them are also false visions of faith. And what they all have in common is that each of them would be examples of Jesus using his faith and status for personal gain rather than helping others. So, for instance, we can look at the first temptation. Turn that stone into a loaf of bread, right? Because he's not eating in the desert. He's very hungry. The devil says, why don't you just turn that stone into a loaf of bread? Well, what the devil is really suggesting in this temptation is that Jesus should use his faith to make himself more physically comfortable. And in the context of being hungry, in a way, it seems like a pretty innocent thing. Just use that, use your power to make some bread, Jesus, so you don't have to be hungry. But, you know, imagine if this kind of pattern became the center of Jesus' life, where every time something was uncomfortable, every time something was unpleasant, Jesus would pull away. I mean, imagine if that was the case, would he have ever gone to the cross? And imagine if comfort had become the center of Jesus' mission rather than service. You know, you could imagine where this would lead just in this story. You know, make yourself some bread, and while you're at it, why not make yourself a drink? And while you're at it, why not make yourself a nicer meal? And then you can conjure up a palace, and then you can make yourself a nice leather couch, and you can do some future creation and create a flat screen TV and watch some, you know, Real Housewives of Las Vegas or something. You know, make yourself real comfortable. You have the power to do it, Jesus, so why don't you just live a life of luxury and comfort? Now, I hope it sounds ridiculous to you that Jesus would do anything like this in this story, and it does, and yet how do people in this world usually use their power and influence? For instance, when we imagine, have you ever been asked, what would you do if you win the lottery? Sometimes when we think about what we do, you know, we think about being generous to friends and family, but a lot of times some of the first things to come to our minds are images of luxury and comfort and entertainment. Well, it turns out that Jesus just isn't very like us in this respect, right? Jesus in this story practices self-denial, and he doesn't build his life around self-centered physical comforts. Instead, he reminds Satan that man doesn't live by bread alone, because all these luxuries and physical comforts, they can certainly bring pleasure for a few moments, but they can never bring true fulfillment and true life and true salvation. Jesus knows only God can do that. And so Jesus can handle the hunger in his body because in his soul he is full, and so he rejects this first temptation. Well, Satan doesn't want to give up too early, so he goes to Jesus again with another temptation. He says, worship me, and I will give you all dominion over all the kingdoms of the world. So here Jesus is the devil is suggesting to Jesus that he should use his faith to gain political power. And once again, this is kind of how humans think about power in the world, right? Again, imagine yourself as the most powerful person in the world and think about the images that would come to mind if you were doing this. What would you see yourself, what kind of position would you see yourself in? You know, usually in our mind's eye, when we think about power, powerful people are presidents and kings. Powerful people command armies and governments. Powerful people are CEOs and celebrities. Powerful people attend important meetings with important people. In a big way, powerful people live their lives separate from a lot of normal people. They have different relationships. They have different world they live in. They're certainly usually separated from the marginalized and the struggling people and just normal people. This is how we in the world envision power. And make no mistake, Jesus certainly is a powerful person. He's the Son of God, after all. But what Jesus knows is that he doesn't need Satan and greed to become Lord of this world. That's the funny thing about this temptation. Satan is offering Jesus something he already has. Jesus already is the Lord of this world. And once again, in terms of what that means for Jesus, the power he has, Jesus is not very much like us. Because even though Jesus holds more power than anyone, he uses his power in an entirely different way than the usual rulers of this world, because his way of ruling is about love and compassion and mercy. His way of ruling is about being connected with broken people and hurting people and excluded people. And so once again, Jesus turns down Satan's offer because Satan can't offer him anything that he doesn't already have as God's son, as Lord of the world. Well, Satan tries one more time and he offers him one more temptation. He says, jump off the temple of Jerusalem so that you can prove that God will have your back, so that you can prove that God will protect you. Well, what Satan is really suggesting in this temptation is that Jesus should use his faith to make himself more popular, more amazing, by becoming a spectacle instead of a savior, right? It's basically a temptation of, do a magic trick, Jesus, and if you do a magic trick, you'll prove your status to the world, and people will be amazed with you and impressed with you, and they'll love you, and you'll be so popular, Jesus, if you would just prove to the people how important you really are to God. But again, Jesus doesn't need to test God's love because he already knows he's loved. He's already heard this in his baptism. And Jesus isn't about to become some celebrity magician in order to win a popularity contest, because Jesus' faith in God is about service, not celebrity. It's about salvation and not spectacle. And so, unlike us a lot of the time, Jesus isn't that interested in being liked. That's why he was crucified, after all, right? He wasn't that interested in being liked. He's interested in being faithful to his mission of love and mercy. And so, once again, Jesus rejects Satan's temptation. Well, what relevance does this story of Jesus' temptation have to do with us? Well, we could go on and we could look at different lessons of how Jesus' actions can inspire our own lives. And certainly when Jesus lifts up, for instance, the importance of spiritual bread over physical bread, we can be reminded not to get caught up in physical luxuries at the expense of our call to be service people and generous people. And when Jesus rejects the opportunity to become a worldly ruler, we can be reminded that our call is also to use our power in service to others rather than in ways that are greedy. And when Jesus passes up the opportunity to become a celebrity magician and to become popular and win a popularity contest, we can be reminded that our discipleship is about service, not celebrity and good feelings, but it's about who we are as self-giving people. All of these are valid lessons that remind us that we are called also to live for others and to use our gifts shared with others. And these are always good lessons to remember. But maybe the best thing we can take from a story like this is just to say, thanks be to God that Jesus is not like us. Jesus is always more loving, more self-giving, more forgiving, more faithful than we can ever be. And that's why we can also rely on Jesus to be faithful to us, even as we hobble along as very broken, imperfect disciples. We can take heart. Jesus does what we can't do. Jesus remains faithful to God and faithful to us until the end. Amen.